Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There's a strange moment that happens right before a major trial begins where the air feels heavier, slower, like the entire system is holding its breath, and that's where we are right now with the Brian Walsh case. A full jury is seated. Opening statements are set for the first time since Anna Walsh vanished on New Year's Day of 2023. We're about to watch all the pieces laid out in a single room under the harsh, steady light of a courtroom. And this is one of those cases where you can feel the friction before a single word is spoken, because this isn't a simple whodunit. It's a story built from digital trails, shifting timelines, disappearing trash bags, and two people living lives that looked polished on the outside, but were fraying badly underneath. If you're just walking into this case now, it's easy to assume you've missed the beginning of the movie. You haven't. This is where the real story is finally going to unravel. Everything up to this point has been snapshots, arrest affidavits, press conferences, hearings, where only fragments of evidence are mentioned. But the central tension hasn't changed. Prosecutors believe Brian Walsh murdered his wife, Anna, dismembered her, and disposed of her remains in a series of desperate trips across Massachusetts, all while he was under federal monitoring for an art fraud scheme. The defense says the evidence is circumstantial, the timelines aren't airtight, and there's no body. And now that Brian has pled guilty to misleading police and improper disposal, but not murder, the stage is set for a trial where the line between what he admits and what he denies becomes the entire story. I'm curious to get your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube as we work our way through this. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, find this story, and let us know your thoughts. Just search Brian Walsh if you're listening to the podcast, and you'll find this video version of the story on YouTube. If you're already there, hit subscribe for me, please, and then your thoughts as we work through this. To understand how we got here, you have to understand who Brian Walsh is, or at least who he pretended to be, or presented himself to be. Brian allegedly grew up with privilege, with social connections that opened doors most people never even knew existed. But privilege without structure is a dangerous thing. He drifted, he reinvented himself a few times, and eventually landed in the world of high-end art. where authenticity is everything and where a skilled manipulator can exploit that trust for profit. The art fraud case isn't a minor footnote. It is the backdrop. When Anna went missing, Brian was awaiting sentencing for selling fake Andy Warhol paintings, like you do. He wasn't looking at a slap on the wrist. He was looking at real prison time. And unlike a lot of people who stumble into criminal trouble late in life, Brian had a pattern of dishonesty that prosecutors will absolutely want the jury to understand. Not as he did a bad thing once, so he must have done a worse thing later, but as evidence of a person capable of maintaining an entire double identity without blinking. His marriage to Anna was complicated, and that's putting it gently. Anna was a powerhouse. She built her life from scratch, an immigrant who worked her way up to a senior leadership position at Titchum Spire, traveling constantly, problem-solving constantly, and managing a life in two cities. She was the one with the career trajectory, the salary, the upward momentum. She was also the one keeping the household afloat while Brian was tethered to home confinement. Friends describe her as exhausted but determined, someone who kept moving forward even when things at home weren't stable. And that's not speculation. It's what you get from people who saw her in the final weeks. There were signs that she was reevaluating things, and who the hell wouldn't be if that's your husband? New job commitments in D.C., references to needing a fresh start, comments about pressure at home. Nothing as dramatic as planning to leave her marriage tomorrow, but enough to suggest a woman trying to stabilize her life when the foundation around her was cracking. The last 48 hours of her life are absolutely essential because this is the timeline everything else hangs on. On December 31st, Brian and Anna had dinner with friends. A fairy tale. No, a fairly normal gathering with some small talk, some wine, holiday energy, a normal get-together. But the friend later said they noticed tension. Anna seemed distracted. There was something off in the dynamic. Then came the early hours of January 1st, where Brian claims Anna took a ride share to the airport for a sudden trip to D.C. The problem with that story? There's no record of any ride share. Yeah, they don't do it on paper, Brian, and toss it out the window. Oops. There's no Uber, there's no Lyft, there's no taxi, there's no friend, there's nothing. And there's no evidence Anna ever left the house. Her phone went dark, her credit card silent, her presence erased. The only person who had contact with Anna after that dinner was Brian. Or so the prosecution argues. Between January 1st and January 3rd, Brian's movements became one of the prosecution's strongest points because he wasn't supposed to be going anywhere. He was under house arrest with strict monitoring, yet he left the home repeatedly. And when investigators eventually got access to surveillance footage, they say it revealed a man traveling to multiple stores, buying cleaning supplies, mops, buckets, tarps, tape, and at one point a massive roll of plastic bags. He wasn't subtle about it. That's not editorializing this either. That's what the receipts show. Then there's the digital evidence. And this is where things move from suspicious to deeply incriminating. If the prosecution can validate every piece the way they intend to, on Brian's devices, investigators say they found a series of Google searches in the early morning hours of January 1st. Searches like, how long before a body starts to smell? Can you be charged with murder without a body? 10 ways to dispose of a dead body? And so on. This isn't mild curiosity. This isn't looking up a true crime documentary. These are questions typed in the exact window of time when prosecutors allege Anna was killed. The defense will undoubtedly push back hard on the digital timeline. Who typed the searches? When exactly? Whether the timestamps are accurate? Whether another device synced information? Anything to break the chain of causation. But it's rare, very rare, that jurors look at those types of searches and think, well, maybe it's nothing. Who doesn't look that stuff up in conjunction with their significant other being missing and blood on a knife in their basement and massive amounts of cleaning supplies and clear evidence that he hit a body, lied to investigators. That part is now part of the record. He's admitted to those parts, just not the murder itself. The evidence that followed only tightened the circle. Investigators found blood in the basement. They found a damaged, bloody knife. They tracked trash disposal routes that lined up with Brian's known movements, and in a trash station miles away, bags were recovered containing bloodied items believed to have belonged to Anna. This is going to work out great in court, isn't it? He's totally going to walk. When you place those bags next to the footage of Brian allegedly disposing of trash across multiple municipalities, you start to see the shape of the state's theory. Not because of a single smoking gun, but because the pieces, the movement, the timing, the purchases, the digital footprints, discarded materials form a grid that's kind of hard to escape. The defense will try. And they should, that's their job, but their strategy is inherently constrained. They can't argue nothing happened. Brian already admitted he misled police and improperly disposed of something. They can't argue Anna left voluntarily. Her entire digital life ceased instantly. They can't rely on a lack of the body alone because juries convict without one all of the time. You don't need a body to convict. When the surrounding evidence is strong, the defense's best argument is to focus on the gaps. Every nobody case has them. They'll pick apart the timeline. They'll argue contamination or misinterpretation of blood evidence. They'll suggest that the digital searches aren't definitively tied to the moment the state says they are, but they are. They may argue that grief, panic, and fear of being blamed for Anna's disappearance drove Brian's bizarre behavior, not guilt. They may suggest that the marriage was complicated, but not violent. They may present alternative explanations for the basement scene, but they are walking into trial without the ability to anchor their narrative into a consistent alternative scenario. Their job is to unsettle what the prosecution is presenting, not to present a better story. And that brings us to one of the strangest developments heading into this trial. Brian pleading guilty to the lesser charges. It's not just a procedural detail. It is a massive tactical choice. When a defendant pleads guilty to misleading investigators and improper disposal of a body, but still insists he didn't commit the murder, it creates kind of a split perception that juries are going to have to navigate. On one hand, it removes some of the most damaging behavior from the jury's burden of proof. They don't have to decide whether he lied. He did. They don't have to decide whether he disposed of something he shouldn't have. He already says he did. But on the other hand, jurors also walk in knowing he tampered with the investigation, knowing he hid something, knowing he tried to throw police off the trail. And even though jurors are instructed to compartmentalize, human beings don't operate in neat legal boxes. They don't. Jury selection reflected that. It was difficult, emotional, and methodical. Finding people who can sit in judgment of a man accused of killing his wife is already challenging. Finding people who can process digital evidence objectively is another hurdle. There's also the issue of three children left behind, which adds yet another emotional layer. You need jurors who can hear nobody and not immediately jump to either assumption, guilt, or innocence. That's harder to find than most people think. But the court has seated a jury, and that means the case is finally ready to unfold publicly. When openings begin, the prosecution will tell a story about a marriage quietly coming apart, a man backed into a financial and legal corner, and a woman trying to build an independent life while navigating an increasingly unstable home environment. They'll argue motive, rooted in control, fear of exposure, and the looming consequences of Brian's federal crimes. They'll connect the dots of the timeline, the purchases, the searches, the trips, the trash, the inconsistencies. They'll present a case where every piece isn't perfect, but every piece aligns. The defense, meanwhile, will emphasize what isn't known. They'll stress that the timeline isn't airtight. They'll question how digital data was collected and interpreted. They'll highlight every scientific analysis that isn't definitive. They may even argue that law enforcement collapsed too quickly into Brian as the only suspect, ignoring other possibilities. But without a clear alternative narrative, they're left with the challenge of trying to convince jurors that a constellation of coincidences is just that, coincidence. And when we talk about stakes, this case is heavy. If Brian is convicted of first-degree murder, it's effectively a life sentence. There is no parole option in Massachusetts. There are the children left without their mother and potentially without their father. And I would argue the best thing to ever happen to those children is for dad to be locked away for the rest of his life. Because there is nothing good this man has to offer next of kin. There isn't. Mom did, but she's gone. And if dad did what he's accused of doing in this case and all the others, yeah, you may have lucked out in some sick, weird ways, kids, that this man couldn't be a more impactful point of your life in a far more insidious way than he already has been. There's a federal sentencing still to come, which could be rendered irrelevant if the jury recommends life. And there's the broader conversation about domestic violence, domestic forensics, and the idea of no body, no crime, which this trial will almost certainly be cited in for years to come. But perhaps the most important part of this trial, the part people feel in their gut, is the story of a woman who disappeared without leaving any trace of herself behind. Because that's the hole at the center of this case. Anna doesn't get to walk into the courtroom. Anna doesn't get to testify. The prosecution has to reconstruct her final moments through data, debris, and digital echoes. The defense has to argue that absence is not proof. And the jury has to decide what happened to a woman who loved her children, worked like hell to build her life, and vanished in a way that defies any explanation that doesn't involve violence. This isn't a trial about a single moment. It's a trial about a pattern of stress, of lies, of financial collapse, of a marriage that was no longer functioning, of actions taken in the shadows when someone thought nobody was watching. It's a test of how much weight circumstantial evidence can carry when it aligns too neatly to ignore. It's a test of whether a body is necessary for truth to be found. And it's a reminder that the most chilling crimes are not the ones committed by strangers in dark alleys, but the ones that happen quietly in homes people assume are safe. As we head into the first day of testimony on December 1st, everything will shift from speculation to sworn statements. The prosecution will lay their cards on the table. The defense will reveal its true strategy. Witnesses will reconstruct the fragments of Anna's final days. The digital evidence will be scrutinized line by line, and the jury will begin to go through the slow process, the uncomfortable work of deciding whether Brian Walsh is responsible for the death of his wife. Whatever the outcome, this trial is about to tell the story that has been trapped beneath layers of surveillance footage, search logs, and missing pieces for nearly 3 years. And that's why we're here, to finally watch the story unfold one piece at a time, until the truth, or at least the closest version a courtroom can reach, comes into focus. We'll be carrying it for you right here, so you can watch, listen, discuss. We'll be talking about it every day, breaking down this case. Be sure to press subscribe right now, wherever you're listening to us in the podcast world, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, whatever it is, hit subscribe. Also, check out our YouTube channel if you're not already there. Once you do get there, or if you are there, hi. Subscribe, please hit that subscribe button down there. That is going to make sure that you get all the coverage right to you and your feed every day. It also helps us a bit, lets people know that we're covering this case, and we're trying to get to 100,000 subscribers on YouTube before the end of the year. We'll see if we make that. We need your help to do so, so please do hit subscribe if you're watching right now to help with that. We do really appreciate it. If you like our reporting, thank you so much for that, and thank you for hitting subscribe. Please give me your thoughts in the comment section as we discuss these cases on YouTube. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches, but there aren't, right?
Right, because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want, choose delivery or pickup, and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana. Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.